We're continuing in this series of messages I'm doing this year. We're basically doing an overview of the whole Bible. I've titled the series, The Great Rescue, The Bible and Being Found by God. And I'm convinced that that is what the message of the Bible is about. God is seeking to rescue us. We have been covering some different portions of the Bible. We started out with talking about issues of the creation and kind of the beginnings of things in Genesis. We moved on from there to talk about the Exodus from slavery in Egypt and the conquest of the Promised Land. And we're now going to move into another phase in the history of Israel. We're going to be talking about the period of the judges and the period of the kings for a few weeks here. So let me talk to you a little bit about my parents. My parents loved God since they were young children. And as young people, they felt that God had called them to serve in the mission field. Before they even knew each other, they had both surrendered to that call, and then they met, and that was one of the things that drew them together, was this common calling from God to the mission field. They devoted their lives to following God's lead, and that for them meant a lifetime spent serving in Spain and 6 years in Bosnia. Growing up with them, we experienced many challenges. Life wasn't always easy, but my parents always turned their eyes to God. And whatever crisis we faced, none of them ever succeeded in destroying our lives. I responded to Jesus in faith as a child, and I too have chosen a similar path to theirs. I too have found in my own life that God has been faithful every step of the way. Mine is a wonderful experience of generational faith. Perhaps you have experienced something similar. But what happens when one generation turns from the faith of the previous one? That's what we're going to see today as we consider the period of the judges in Israel's history. I've titled today's message, When We Turn From God. We're going to be looking in Judges chapter 2, beginning in verse 6. So before we start reading, let me catch us up. We saw last week that at the end of the period of coming into the land and conquering the land, when Joshua finally was old and realized he was going to die soon, he summoned all of Israel together and he gave them the charge we were looking at last week. And after Joshua dies, we enter into this period we call the period of the judges. Joshua did not establish somebody to succeed him as kind of a leader for all of Israel. So we enter into a different period in the history of Israel. And if we look in Judges, the first chapter, it explains, you know, we saw last week that when Joshua summons Israel, they have almost finished taking the Promised Land. But we see in Judges 1 that Joshua tells them, go ahead and finish what you've started. God will be faithful just as he's been thus far, and you will finish taking over all of the territories that you need to. But we see in the first thing we read in the next book, Judges, is how the Israelites did not succeed in dispossessing the final few people groups that were remaining, the largest of them being the Philistines on the western coast of the Mediterranean there. But it describes specifically where what territories and what tribes have failed to completely take over the territory that they were supposed to take over. And then in the opening of chapter 2, the angel of Yahweh, kind of God himself, shows up to talk to Israel. And he tells them, because you have not done what I told you to do, which was finish dispossessing these peoples and taking over this land and putting an end to the evil that they have been perpetrating here, because you have failed to do that, but have instead chosen to make alliances with them, God says, I am no longer going to drive them out. You are now not going to be able to dispossess these peoples, and they are going to be a stumbling block for you. And that's where we pick it up here in verse 6. And when Joshua dismissed the people, the children of Israel went each man to his own inheritance to possess the land. And the people served Yahweh all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work of Yahweh that he had done for Israel. And Joshua, son of Nun, servant of Yahweh, died at 110 years of age. And they buried him within the border of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres on the mountain of, on a mountain of Ephraim north of Mount Gaash. And also that entire generation was gathered to its ancestors. Then there arose another generation after them that did not know Yahweh or the work he had done for Israel. So we arrive here at the end of Joshua's life, and he's dismissing the people after we saw that passage we looked at last week at the end of the book of Joshua, where he summons Israel and talks to them. He dismisses them, and everybody goes back to the territory that they have been allotted, their own personal inheritance. And we are told that the people served Yahweh all the days of Joshua. So as long as Joshua was alive, the people kept covenant. They observed the instructions God had given them for how they were to go about worshiping him. They followed the commandments that were in the law, and they lived their lives basically under God's guidance and leadership. So the whole lifetime of Joshua, that was what held. And then even after Joshua died, the elders who had been leading right alongside Joshua, who outlived Joshua because Joshua was older than anybody else, he and Caleb, those who outlived him but who had lived through the same events that Joshua had lived through, Israel continued in the same pattern of living under this kind of leadership. And it says that these are people who had seen all the great work Yahweh had done for Israel. So we're talking about people. Now Joshua is old enough that he remembers the departure from Egypt. But the rest of these elders probably are also able to remember that. They were perhaps children at the time of the departure from Egypt, but they have seen the faithfulness of God through the wilderness wandering. They've seen how their parents missed out when they didn't trust God, and they have seen how when they trusted God, he parted the Jordan River, and when it was overflowing, and let them cross on dry land and get over into the promised land, and God tore down the walls around the city of Jericho without them having to do anything. And they saw in battle after battle how God granted them victory and protected them, and they were unstoppable because God was with them. They had all experienced this firsthand, and they knew they were in this crisis reality with them coming into the promised land. If God had not sustained them, they would have been eliminated. This was really a life and death situation for them. And they chose to put their trust in Yahweh, and they experienced firsthand Yahweh's faithfulness. He gave them the promised land. They had experienced that personally. And of course, it's a lot easier to walk with God when you have personally experienced his deliverance and his faithfulness. So we're told Joshua dies at 110 years of age, and he was from the tribe of Ephraim. His territory was within the territory of Ephraim, somewhere on some mountain of Ephraim near north of the Mount Gaash, which today we have no idea where it is. That's kind of a mountainous, hilly area of the territory. So somewhere on one of those hills he was buried. And we're told that after he dies, that entire generation is gathered to its ancestors. And that's a Hebrew euphemism to describe the fact that they died. The practice back then when you died was that you were put into the family tomb, which tended to be like a cave or something. So you would be gathered to your ancestors. You would be placed in the same burial place as your ancestors had been placed. So this entire generation dies after Joshua has died, and then we hear this ominous sentence. Then there arose another generation after them that did not know Yahweh or the work he had done for Israel. These kids grew up under the blessings that God had showered on their parents, but they had not experienced any of the challenges. They had not experienced the life and death situations that their parents faced. They just walked into it at the tail end of it, and they didn't know. Now, here's the thing. I know these kids had to have been participating with their parents in all that they were doing. So it would be the equivalent today of these kids grew up in church. These kids grew up going to the tabernacle, participating in the feasts and bringing sacrifices, the first fruits, and at the close of the harvest and the Day of Atonement. They grew up knowing and participating in all of this because that was the faith of their parents. And they were walking in this genuine relationship with God. But these kids, they grew up with all of the trappings of that relationship with God, but never actually had a relationship with God. You might wonder, how does that happen? They didn't know the work God had done because they didn't live the things that their parents had lived. How does that happen? Well, you may have heard the phrase before that God has no grandchildren. I believe it's theologically accurate to say that. Now, in the New Testament, under the new covenant of faith in Jesus, we are told two ways to describe this. When we come to faith in Jesus, we are either born again. Miraculously, God causes by the gift of His Holy Spirit in us a new birth, and we become a whole new creation in Him. That's one way to describe what happens. Another way is to describe that when we come to faith in Jesus, God officially adopts us into His family. And in Roman culture, what that meant was all past debts are canceled because it's like you have a complete new identity. And you now belong to this whole other family and you're a whole different kind of thing. That's why Paul liked to use the language of adoption to describe this. But either way, what God does when we put our faith in Him is He introduces us into His family as His children. But that does not transfer to my children. It doesn't happen. You don't just inherit faith. Your parents can do all they can, and they can faithfully walk with God, and they can tell you as a child, the only reason I'm here today is that God is faithful. You can tell them till you're blue in the face, but that is not going to mean that they are going to know the faith that you have, because they must choose it for themselves. They must come to God and choose to put their trust in Him. Let's continue in verse 11. And the children of Israel did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, and they served the Baals. They abandoned Yahweh, God of their ancestors, the one who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples that surrounded them. And they bowed down to them, and they angered Yahweh. They abandoned Yahweh and served Baal and the Ashtoreths. So what happens when you have a generation that doesn't know God and does not recognize His hand at work, doesn't see what God's up to? And that's the thing. If you're not in this relationship with God, you don't see what God's doing. He's still doing it. But if you don't know Him, you're absolutely blind to it. So the children of evil did evil in the eyes of Yahweh. And this is a phrase that's going to be used throughout the Old Testament, the eyes of Yahweh. And we will be told over and over in the coming narrative passages that such and such a person did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, or such and such a person did what was right in the eyes of Yahweh. And what the Bible is telling us is that God is watching. God is paying attention to us. Some people think God is somewhere way far away. He's off in heaven doing his thing. He's completely unconcerned and disconnected. And if you don't know God, that's probably the way you think everything is happening. You're not aware of what he's up to. You're blind to it. And you might think God is oblivious to what's going on in your life. But the Bible makes it very clear. God is watching what's going on in your life. The eyes of God are observing. This is obviously an anthropomorphism. We're using human language to describe what God's doing. But what it means is that God's attention is focused on our lives. And I'll tell you why. God is watching because he loves us. And when you love someone, you pay attention to what's going on with them. They say that the opposite of love is not hatred, it's indifference. God is not indifferent. He is watching. And when he looks down on this new generation that comes up, he says, what they are doing is evil. We talked last week about why God brought Israel in to dispossess these peoples, because their patterns, cultural patterns of behavior, were predatory and abusive. And God wanted to cleanse human history of their influence. And when the children of Israel join in this rather than getting rid of it, they become part of the evil that God intended to remove. And what they are doing is evil in the eyes of Yahweh. God looks and pays attention and says, I know where they're headed. And it's nowhere good. There's nothing good about what they're trying to do. What are they doing? They are serving the Baals. Likely we're talking just about the storm god Baal, which was the primary Canaanite deity. The Ammonites, the Moabites, the Philistines had other gods, but the primary Canaanite deity was Baal, the storm god. And using the plural there probably just indicates that we're talking about a lot of different high places and a lot of different places of worship and different flavors of how they were worshiping this storm god. But they're serving, not Yahweh. They're not following Yahweh. They are serving this Baal god. And we're told that they abandoned Yahweh, the God of their ancestors. And we look back in the history and we see God's faithfulness to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob and to Joseph. And after their time in Egypt, where they fall into slavery, how God does not abandon the children of Israel, but sends Moses back and delivers them and gets them out of there and places them into the promised land. This is the God who has been faithful to all their ancestors. In fact, the God who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. Now, this generation doesn't care. They don't know. But if it weren't for God's intervention, they would still be slaves in Egypt. They don't know. So many times when children grow up in a home with parents who are walking with God, they just assume the blessings they were born into are just standard human experience. That's just what it means to be human, and everything works out great, and I'm secure and safe, and everything's going great, and you just assume it. Not because God is good, but you just think that's just the way the life works out. Everything is here to make things great for you. And they don't recognize that the only reason they are where they are right now is God's faithfulness. Their starting point is so far ahead of what the starting point of their ancestors was. So what do? They go after other gods. They choose from among the gods of the peoples that are surrounding them, and they go and bow down to these gods. And they angered Yahweh. Here's another thing the Bible makes very clear about Yahweh. Not only is he watching, but he is emotionally invested in us. He's not impassive. God is not It bugs me sometimes when philosophy of religion people start arguing about God, because they start talking about God like he's a thing, not a person. And they talk about his attributes and what he can or can't do and all these things, and they forget that we're talking about an actual person who actually has an emotional investment in the creation he has made. God, because he loves us, he cares enough that what we are doing affects him emotionally. And throughout the Bible, we see God not as some force of the universe out there, but as a person who is passionately involved in what is going on with us. So what happens when people walk away from God and start embracing this corrupt, abusive, patriarchal society structure and start buying into it? And it isn't just patriarchy. It's patriarchy combined with ritual prostitution and putting women and girls into prostitution because that's what the gods demand. How convenient for the men, right? And they're not changing that. They are becoming a part of it. And what is God's reaction? He gets angry. Because they should have known better. Because he had laid before them something so much better. And their parents had showed to them that it works. That when you walk with God, you experience a blessed living, not a problem-free living. But you experience the very real guidance, protection, and blessing of God. And they chose to turn away from that, and this angered Yahweh. Why? Because they abandoned him and went after Baal and the Ashtoreths. These were the two big deities, Baal and Asherah. And Asherah was the goddess of fertility, the goddess of war. You might say, well, why would they do that? Their parents had shown them so much better. Well, let's compare the worship. You went to worship at the tabernacle. There were no statues. You couldn't make a little statue of Yahweh and put it in your pocket to conveniently pray to him whenever you needed and have something tangible. You went to a place where you understood the God you are worshiping is invisible because he's too great for all of creation. You can't confine him to a building or a statue. And they came in gratitude, offering gifts of fellowship and recognition of guilt and all the rich tapestry of a sacrificial language and all the things that were involved. And they participated in all of this. But then they started talking to these neighboring people. How does worship work with you guys? Well, the gods need us to have sex with these young ladies because that's the way fertility happens, and that's the way the cows will have milk and babies, and the seed we plant is going to grow and bear a lot of fruit. And all the gods need this energy from us, and we dutifully go and have sex with these women, and we offer our sacrifices, and this is the way it works. So think of the young men growing up in a patriarchal society. You can go to the tabernacle where there's nobody to have sex with, or you can go worship Baal and have sex with someone. Which do you think these young men found more interesting? Clearly, they decided this is something I will enjoy more. This is something I'm desiring, something I want. And here it's sanctioned. Here it's forbidden. Here I can only have sex with my wife. Here I can have sex with all these other women. So they started joining into this abusive culture and worship. And make no mistake, I mean, this is patriarchal culture. But what they've done here is establish a religion where women are not only property of their husbands, but they are involved in the whole worship language of the culture so that they are sex objects for any man, not just a husband. And the people of Israel, instead of being horrified by that, begin to join into it. Verse 14, then the anger of Yahweh burned against Israel, and he delivered them into the hands of plunderers who plundered them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, and they were no longer able to stand before their enemies. In all they went out to do, the hand of Yahweh was against them for evil, just as Yahweh had spoken, and just as Yahweh had sworn to them, and he distressed them greatly. So what does God do when he's angry? He stops doing what he had been doing. He had been protecting. He had been guiding. He had been granting them victory. He stops doing all of that. No more protection. No more victory. And all of a sudden, they become the object of abuse from the people around them who come and plunder them. They just take what they want. They are surrounded by enemies all around, and they find for the first time something they always assumed would never happen, but all of a sudden they can't stand up to anybody. They're experiencing what the local people in Canaan had experienced when Israel first came in. No matter how hard they tried, they could not face Israel. Well, now it works the other way around. God is no longer protecting. And they discover very quickly, when God's not a part of my life, when I'm facing things in my own strength, based on what I can bring to the table, boy, is it a different picture. Here's the great irony. You know who it is that's plundering them? You know who these enemies are all around? Who are attacking them and they cannot stand up to them. These are the guys that supposedly were friends. These are the guys who first introduced them to Baal worship. And once they have enticed them to join them in this, they discover very quickly these aren't friends at all. They just wanted to take what I have, and they knew the only way they could access that is if they got us away from God's protection. That continues to happen today. There are all kinds of people out there trying to entice us and entice our children away from faith. And whoever it is, this new atheist or neo-pagan or whatever it is, they pretend to be your closest friend and they speak to you of the glories of all the things you're going to enjoy and get to do, and your life is going to be so much better if you throw off the shackles of your parents' faith. It's going to be so much fun, and you chase right after them and you abandon Yahweh and you turn to these other gods with your new friends. And you know what you find out before very long? That these friends don't love you at all. And they take everything they can from you. And oftentimes it's the very people who drew you away who hurt you most deeply. And they'll suck you dry. Because they have no interest in you. They just want what they can take from you. That's exactly what Israel experiences here. They turn away from God and God says, okay, you don't want to walk with me? Walk on your own. Face the people around you in your own strength. Let's see how that goes. And God is consistent in everything they try to do. God's hand is against them for evil. God is not going to benefit or bless their wickedness in any way. Every single thing they're trying to do, God is very deliberately going to withdraw any blessing from that. You see, God can't bless selfishness. He can't bless cruelty or pettiness. But notice what God said, what the author reminds us of here. Just as Yahweh had spoken, just as Yahweh had sworn to them. Now, sometimes people do this. They grow up in a context of faith, and they say, I'm just going to walk away from that. I'm going to do my own thing. And then when the bottom drops out from them, and their life crumbles around them, they have the audacity to turn back to God and say, why, God? Like it's his fault you walked away from him. And he warned you, I am not going to bless that. He has sworn, I am not doing that. And God's very upfront about this. He's not going to sanction a self-centered life for you. He's not going to feed it. He's not going to shower his blessings on it. You're on your own. You walk away from him, you face life on your own merits. And let's see how well it goes for you. We might think that's the end of it, but it isn't. Verse 16, then Yahweh raised up judges, and they delivered them from the hand of those who were plundering them. And yet they would not listen to those who judged them, because they prostituted themselves after other gods and bowed down to them. They turned aside quickly from the way in which their parents had walked, who listened to the commandments of Yahweh. This they did not do. And when Yahweh raised up judges for them, Yahweh was with the judge and delivered them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge, because Yahweh was moved to pity by their groaning in the presence of those who oppressed and harassed them. And it came to pass that when the judge died, they would turn back and behave more corruptly than their parents, following other gods, serving them, and bowing down to them. They did not abandon their actions, nor their stubborn way. We might think that's the end of it. They've turned away from God. God says, I'm done helping. But that's not quite what happens. The very next thing we read is, he raises up judges to deliver them. And when we read of judges in the book of Judges, we're not really talking about what we think of judges. You know, somebody who sits on a bench and hears court cases and makes sure the law is being followed. This was a very different context. The judges, even though there are some instances in the book of Judges where people come to the judges to help resolve some kind of a dispute, largely the judges were military leaders, and they would gather the fighting people of a tribe or a couple of tribes, and they would fight off some neighboring people that was coming in and plundering and abusing them and provide some relief. But they weren't even really kings. They didn't gather taxes. They didn't live in a palace. They didn't have a court. They were just kind of ad hoc leaders who rose up and gathered together the military forces so that they could fight off enemies. But God raises up these judges, and they deliver them from the hand of the people who are plundering them. And not surprisingly, these judges that God has raised up find that the same people who have no interest in listening to Yahweh have no interest in listening to them either. They're going to do their own thing. So even though this is kind of an image of what has happened on a larger scale with God himself. Even though God is the one who has delivered them, they don't want to listen to him. And the same thing is happening with the judges he raises up. They are delivering them, but they don't want to listen. They want the benefit, but no change, because they are obstinately committed to prostituting themselves after other gods. Now that language is very prophetic. The prophets talk about worshiping other gods as adultery. And the image continues in the New Testament, where even under the New Covenant, we are told that the church is the bride of Christ. And our whole journey with him is a spiritual journey of growth and discipleship, so that when the wedding day comes, the grand moment of unification with him and stepping into eternity with him, we will be found to be a spotless, pure bride. That's the language we use in the New Testament, so that when we turn away from Christ to other things, and when we abandon faith in him and pursue other avenues in life, we are committing spiritual adultery. We are being unfaithful. to the one we have promised ourselves to. And you might think that's kind of the way we're talking here, but let's remember when we're talking about Israel at this point in their history, and when we use language of prostitution and adultery, we're not being metaphorical. This Baal worship literally involved adultery. It literally involved prostitution. We're not being figurative here. They prostituted themselves after other gods. And it's shocking. To this day, we think of ourselves as such enlightened people. But historically, from the oldest, most ancient times to the day, today, one of the things that keeps most people away from God is their commitment to a sexuality that is different from what they know God wants. And people will sacrifice anything to be able to sleep with who they want to sleep with. Anything. They will sacrifice eternity. They will sacrifice a relationship with God. They will sacrifice the harmony that they have been enjoying with their family. They will sacrifice anything to prostitute themselves after other gods. Quickly, they turned away from the way their parents had been walking. How did their parents walk? They listened to God. Not just what they wanted to hear, they listened to His commandments. They wanted God to tell them how they should live life. They wanted His guidance. They wanted His instruction. They longed to live within the parameters of how God was telling them to live. They wanted to discover what humans are supposed to behave like. And they knew nobody but their Creator had the answer to that question. So that's how their parents lived. That is not what they wanted to do. And this was the pattern in the period of the judges. God raised up a judge, and God was with the judge. And He used the judge to provide relief, to deliver them from the hand of their enemies. And as long as that judge lived, there was that relief. And we're told here why Yahweh was doing this. Because Yahweh was moved to pity by their groaning in the presence of those who oppressed and harassed them. We've already talked about God's anger. Now, God's anger is not like human anger. Our human anger is most of the time very self-centered. We are angry because we want something and nobody's giving it to us. We get upset. We get angry. God doesn't need anything from us. When God gets angry, it's simply His love in action. He knows the damage we are doing to ourselves and to others when we turn away from Him, and that angers Him because He loves us. There's no selfish motive behind any of His anger. But that's not the only thing that's going on in God's heart. Because He sees, when He withdraws His protection, He sees the agony that Israel is suffering, and He hears their groaning. God sees and hears. He listens to us. We may not listen to Him, but He listens to what's going on with us, to the cry of our heart. And the reason God is raising up judges is not that the people of Israel are seeking Him. They're running as fast as they can. The reason God raises up judges is that He is deeply moved. He feels pity for them. They deserve what's happening to them. They have squandered. They are the most privileged generation on the face of the earth. And they have thrown it all away because they just want what everybody else had, which is garbage. And God has every right to be angry with them, but He cannot just be angry because He loves them. You have to understand this about God. He really loves you. And yes, your wickedness angers him because he knows all the good you are, not just that you're depriving yourself of, but all the good you are depriving those around you of, because he intended for you to be a source of blessing to people, not a curse to the people who love you. And that angers him. And he can't bless it. But he doesn't even let us experience the full weight of the consequences we deserve because he has pity on us. We should experience the full horror of our wicked choices. But God tempers it. He intervenes. And it's not nearly as bad as it could be. Why does he do that even when we don't turn back to him? It's because he has compassion for us. Because he loves us. And our agony hurts him. You can't watch somebody you love suffer and not care. And because of that, God provides some relief in the period of the judges. So while the judge is alive, there's some relief. When the judge dies, they just rush right back and say, how can we be even worse than our parents were? How can we dig ourselves even deeper into this absolute denial of God and anything he wants with us? They were stubborn. And they were happy, all too happy to abandon Yahweh. You know what they're not willing to abandon? It's their wicked actions and their stubborn way in life. That, boy, they're loyal to that. You may have had parents who love God. If you're one of those people, you're fortunate. That means you grew up under the umbrella of God's blessing. You may have realized, though, that these blessings are non-transferable. The farther you drift from that faith, the less your life looks like your parents' life. There's a reason for this. God is watching. He's listening. He knows whether we're walking with him or choosing our own selfish path in life. And when we turn away from God, he lets us face the consequences of our own evil actions and our own self-centered living. But he is merciful. He's not going to let it be as bad as it should be. But you know, that's not what you want out of life. You don't want to just scrape by. You don't want to just avoid your life being an utter, horrendous ruin. You're only ever going to know true rest. You're only ever going to know what it is to live under God's blessing if you surrender to this faith in him. If you walk the path, he's inviting you to walk beside him. We're going to sing a song. This is our time to respond. The word of God is God saying something to us, and it's only appropriate that we respond back. I don't know what God's been saying to you this morning. If you have not ever put your heart, your faith in him, then today God is saying, come. Put your faith in me and let's walk this life together. Maybe you already know him, but you've allowed things to turn you away from him, and you need to ask him for forgiveness and recommit yourself to him, to walk closely, to listen carefully, to obey. Whatever it is God's putting on your heart, the altar is open. You can come here, kneel, and speak to God directly yourself. If there's somebody you would like to share what God's put on your heart with and you'd like to pray with them, my wife and I will be here on the side. And you can share with us. We'd be more than happy to pray with you. But take advantage of this time to respond to God and what he's been saying to you today. Let's all stand. Come while we sing.